Today in Studio 360, funny, flirty text messages are turned into poetry.
I am a living male turtleneck. You are an art teacher in winter. You put your whole head through me.
Actual sexting may tend to be creepy and clumsy, but the new It Girl poet, Patricia Lockwood, thinks it does something interesting, and she wanted to give it her own spin.
They're using sexual vocabulary, but the actual sex could not even happen in space.
And later in the show, the performer Taylor Mack reimagines popular songs from every decade in American history as drag numbers. That and much more is ahead today in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
You're dancing around with your eyes.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. Learn more at TiVo.com.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I am Kurt Anderson. On today's show, we'll hear from a diehard punk rocker, Pierce to the Hilt, whose musical life was changed when her mother took her to the opera. But to start the show today, a couple of years ago at an L.A. comedy club, the Comedy Central star Daniel Tosh got in a lot of trouble for joking about rape during a live stand-up set. In the uproar that followed, people responded through blog posts, articles, tweets, but Patricia Lockwood used poetry. It took her a while, but after a year, she published her poem called Rape Joke on a website called The All. It seemed to undermine each side of the argument, managing to be both funny and absolutely heartbreaking. And it also immediately went viral, probably a first for a 1,200-word poem. At age 32, Patricia Lockwood is making a big splash right now in the poetry world. She's got a new book of poems called Motherland, Fatherland, Homeland Sexuals. And she is here with me now. Patricia Lockwood, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So, before we talk, can you read the first few stanzas of Rape Joke?
Yes, I can do that. Rape Joke. The rape joke is that you were 19 years old. The rape joke is that he was your boyfriend. The rape joke, it wore a goatee. A goatee. Imagine the rape joke looking in the mirror, perfectly reflecting back itself, and grooming itself to look more like a rape joke. Ah, it thinks. Yes, a goatee.
Did you have any idea when you wrote that poem that it would make anything like the splash that it did?
No, I don't think anyone writing a poem has any sense that it's going to make any sort of a splash.
Yeah.
More important, it's good not to be thinking about that when you're writing them.
So after it created this huge splash and after being a normal, obscure poet writing poetry for a decade or more, and then you became literally overnight, as famous as a young living poet can probably be. Was that discombobulating or delightful?
It was a little bit discombobulating. I will say that the level of fame a poet can reach in this country is not very high.
Right.
I'm about as famous as, you know, like a local used car dealership owner, maybe, if that. I mean, they used to be athletes, so probably not even that high.
But we're talking about relative fame. You're famous for a poet.
It is relative. That's true. And it is discombobulating because you're not expecting any of it. And poets generally work pretty much in an insulated, very solitary environment. So it can be interesting to have all that feedback resonating at you when you're trying to do this very sort of private practice.
Right. Most of your poetry that I've read is funny, some of it very funny, but not in the way people might think of funny poetry, not in that light verse
right.
way.
It's not stand-up poetry. That's
right.
What I call it.
Is that part of your mission as a poet to sort of prove that real poetry doesn't have to be super earnest necessarily or morose or lugubrious or any of those things?
It's actually a challenge that I've sort of set myself. I would say that my baseline voice when writing poetry tends to be very serious, very grave. But in my actual, you know, life, my interpersonal relationships, I tend to be a funny person. So it was a challenge that I set myself to try to integrate those two voices.
Right. Well, and you tweet prolifically, an average by my count of nine a day since you joined Twitter.
Do I tweet nine a day?
That's what I figured, yeah.
That's high.
You joined only 3 years ago, well into Twitter's existence. So was tweeting a kind of training wheels for this merger of the colloquial and the poetic that you're talking about you've arrived at?
For the merger, yeah, because when I go to Twitter, I'm generally going to say something funny. I'm not going to say something super, super serious. But it's also very literary. So I was doing something there, and I thought it would be possible to carry that over into my poetry. In my poems, people do talk a lot about how I'm a pop culture poet. But I think if people actually go to the poems themselves, there's not as much evidence of that. Whereas in my tweets, I will straight up tweet about the Kool-Aid man. And I'm not necessarily going to do that in a poem.
Right.
So I think that the idiom shifts a little bit, the vocabulary shifts, and the characters shift.
But it sounds – the way you're describing the differences, though, it sounds like they are siblings or cousins, that it's not an entirely other
thing.
Yes, they're
related. Yeah. They are related. Again, it's there's a punchline in poems, whether it's funny or whether it's serious.
Right.
It's still sort of that, you know, sock it to the people at the end.
There are inevitably critics, or at least one whom I read on the New Yorker website, who seems to think your tweeting is an unhealthy habit, that it makes you play to the peanut gallery too much. What do you think
right.
of that?
Which is interesting. You know, no one thought in the past that writers of short stories were just only shut up in their studies all day writing these short stories. They went out at night and they talked to each other about short stories. That's what we're doing now on Twitter, but it's just in a place where everyone can see it, I think.
So instead of the Algonquin Roundtable or wherever poets gather, now
this is our Algonquin Roundtable.
You've written a bunch of tweets that you call sects, S-E-X-T-S. They are surreal and sort of impossible come-ons, and I wonder if you would read a couple or three.
Sure. I am a water glass at the Inquisition. You are a dry pope mouth. You pucker. I wet you. I guess the number of gumballs in a jar. I'm off by just one gumball. I'm pink, it whispers, and then leaps into my mouth. I am a living male turtleneck. You are an art teacher in winter. You put your whole head through me.
Those are wonderful and funny, and they do this funny simultaneously, which is to sexualize everything on Earth.
Everything, popes.
But make that very idea seem ridiculous.
Yeah.
And speaking of funny and confusing and vaguely sexual and seemingly impossible things, your father is a married Catholic priest. How did that happen?
Weird. It's like, how did I even get born? Well, here's how it happened. So he was an atheist. Then he joined the Navy, the submarine service, and he converted under the sea. And so he says, I think that I would like to be a Lutheran, and I think that I would like to enter seminary and study to be a minister. So that's what he did. And for a little while, he was a Lutheran minister. And he was like, wait, this isn't hardcore enough, I guess. And so he said that he was going to convert to Catholicism. But there's a dispensation that the church offers in these sorts of situations where a married minister of another faith converts, you get the option to become a married Catholic priest. It's very rare, although it's going to become, I think, a little more frequent now.
Not to focus on your father so much, but he sounds like a fictional character.
He
went around the house in his cassock and naked sometimes and played the blues guitar and watched old B-movies. Those are all true?
Oh, yeah. Well, they weren't even necessarily B-movies. He really, really liked Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Uh-huh.
But the fact of the matter was you only ever saw him either almost nude in a large pair of tidy whities or just in full Catholic regalia, like gold-trimmed robes and pom-pom hats, that sort of thing. That can really do a number on a girl.
It's really – you grew up in the Wes Anderson movie I haven't seen yet.
Yeah, I don't know that he'd be capable of making that movie.
Did you start reading and liking poetry as a little girl?
Maybe not little, because we didn't actually have a whole lot of literature in our house. But we had a lot of theology, and then we had a lot of Tom Clancy. So the sort of literature that was available to me came later when there was a school library, when I could have teachers sort of guide me in different directions. In my home, it was not so much of a reading home.
You've said an interesting thing about being a kid and about how you didn't feel particularly girlish or boyish. You said you were the 11-year-old gender protagonist. What did you mean exactly?
If you grow up reading, you're inserting yourself into the minds of the narrators. And you have no difficulty if it's some boy who's living in a hollow tree, you know, in some survivalist fantasy, or, you know, like some young kid in a dystopia somewhere. You're just inserting yourself into the viewpoint of the books. And you just come to see yourself as something that transcends gender or that's above those things. Now, I think that young boys don't read as many books where girls are the narrators. So I think that maybe they don't develop that skill in the way that we do.
I read Nancy Drew religiously, so I think
I did.
Did
you like Nancy? Were you a Trixie Belden guy?
No, I was a Nancy guy.
Yeah, I was going to say there's either a Nancy or a Trixie.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
She was spunky.
Contemporary poets, whom we've heard of, teach usually at college and almost always have MFAs these days.
Yeah.
You don't do either of those things.
No.
Do you think that not having that background and not being part of that world is one of the reasons you are inclined to write poems for people outside that hermetic world?
I think that I had a weird voice to start with. I don't think that if I had done an MFA program that it would have beaten it out of me. I know that's the popular conception, but it is possible that I have a wider sense of who an audience can be because I didn't go to school. But otherwise, I would say I think that I ended up pretty much with the directness of tone and the sort of like weirdness of scenario that I would have had otherwise.
Right.
So I'm not sure that lack of schooling is what did it. Maybe the reason I didn't go to school is because I was weird too. You know, it might just all come back to weirdness in the end.
It may be, but and I'm not suggesting it beating it out of you exactly. But if one is young and one is writing for one's fellow would-be poets and poetry teachers, it's got to affect the voice and the
– I think it definitely does. And I think the sway of influence can be a lot more subtle than we know. I was talking about it earlier. You can write to please a teacher. You can write to please who you consider to be the really excellent students in the class or your friends.
Right.
But, I mean, writing groups can do that too.
For sure.
That you can do that just reading too much of one author on your own.
Yep. You married fairly young for these days. You were 21.
These degenerate days.
how does having what sounds like a very solid, splendid, supportive marriage affect or enable the writing you do?
Oh, it enables everything. I get to focus completely on the work. I make him shut up when he's home sometimes. I make him turn off his music. You know, it's just, it's not necessary. I'm the tyrant. And I think that we, looking back over a long history of writers, we're like, damn, they were not good people. They continue to not be very good people. But some people, you know, don't mind that as much. They don't mind, like, yoking their oxen to, you know.
Yeah, for now. But he, you know, he sounds like the kind of perfect, oppressed artist's wife of yore.
Oh, definitely. I just stomp on him. Yeah, all over.
There you go.
He's very oppressed.
And in the future, critics will demand that he get the credit he deserved, that he's been denied all these years.
I hope that there are conspiracy theories that happen in the future about how he secretly wrote it all.
There you go. Well, I really look forward to whatever you come up with next, and I am happy that you've achieved this super celebrity right now for a young poet.
Super celebrity.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, it's been wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Patricia Lockwood's new collection of poems is called Motherland, Fatherland, Homeland, Sexuals, and it is available in bookstores everywhere. Speaking of young poets, I want to thank you, hundreds of you, high school students, for your submissions to our latest listener challenge, Poems About Summer. We're reading through all of them, and we'll pick a winner in a couple of weeks. But in the meantime, here's one more taste of summer before school starts. This poem is called Moving, and it's by 17-year-old Navia from Arizona.
We tore down the treehouse walls, rotting panels and musty curtains, cast old treasures into the mud below. We scrambled down smooth-worn steps that sank beneath our weight. Slowly, suspiciously, as though we were strangers. The backs of our necks were slick with sweat under summer's drowsy heat. The afternoon languor profaned somehow in our holy demolition. But we sacrificed ceremony, worked on into the evening, crickets chirping its smooth arrival. We abandoned the carcass to morning, broken and collapsed on the wet grass. Later, I found you kicking at the skeleton of our fort. You saw me and you looked down, hard. "Don't act like this is sacred," you said. "And when we leave, don't look back."
That was Navya, who lives in Arizona, reading from her poem, Moving. And thanks again to everybody who submitted.
Ernie, what are you typing?
Well, I'm writing a poem, Bert.
Oh, Ernie, I didn't know you were such a poet. That's terrific. Ha!
Coming up, a son and his photographer dad collaborate. 12 years ago,
the drapes behind them make a beautiful triangle shape above their heads.
And today.
I don't think my voice has changed that much.
It's almost the same,
almost the same, yeah.
That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by TiVo, no need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. A dozen years ago, in the very early days of Studio 360, we did a piece about a father and son who had collaborated on a book. The father was a photographer, and the son, who was just 8 years old at the time, wrote stories as captions for each image. That piece was produced by Hilary Frank, who was a pretty green reporter herself back then. Now she hosts a podcast about parenting called The Longest Shortest Time. She recently revisited that father and son to learn about their latest book and what it's like to collaborate as adults.
I met the Romas, Thomas and Giancarlo, at their home in Brooklyn 12 years ago. I loved talking to them. They were so open and honest and funny. They held hands for pretty much the entire interview. The book they made together was called Show and Tell. Thomas, the photographer, did the showing, and Giancarlo, the writer, did the telling. Giancarlo was just 10 years old when I met him, and he'd get sort of choked up every time I asked him to read an excerpt. Here he is reading what he wrote to go with a picture of a man and a boy with their heads down on a kitchen counter.
I think the dad is a fireman because he has a mug with number one, fire. You can't see the AN on the other side. There are bills on the counter, and he's looking through the classifieds. Maybe he can't pay all the bills, and he's looking for another job. There's a piece of classified torn off on the counter. Could be a job that he might want. The drapes behind them make a beautiful triangle shape above their heads. And there's a wedding picture hung next to them on the wall that shows a happier time in the dad's life.
When I read that one, I thought, those are such adult thoughts that you're having. Do you ever feel like you're thinking more like an adult than like a kid?
Sometimes. Yeah, and sometimes it bothers me a little bit because I'm thinking, you know, too far ahead of time, or I'm thinking about all the things that can go wrong instead of right. But, yeah, it occurs to me sometimes.
I asked Thomas about his son and why he thought he seemed like such a little adult.
I think Giancarlo's a very special boy, but I also think people underestimate children. So I'm not sure if it's exactly that it's an adult. I think what he writes like is he writes as if he's a child whose feelings and opinions are valued.
Okay, I'm going to play you one more clip of Thomas from 12 years ago. In this one, he's talking about why he wanted to do the book with Giancarlo in the first place.
I had a friend who was 56 years old and he died suddenly. I was confronted with my mortality in a new way. He was just about my age. And I had realized that Giancarlo had just became old enough where if I did die, he would remember me. You know, some nut screaming for his wife saying, where's my wallet? You know, where's my keys? You know, I'm late for work. You know, what could I do? Sit down with him and say, you know, Dad's afraid of dying and this is what you should know about me. And I realized that most of whatever I'm about, I'm not in touch with anyway. but hopefully it's in our work somewhere.
So back then, I knew that Thomas and Giancarlo's book had something sad behind it. But I didn't realize how sad, and that there was a good reason why Giancarlo, as a young kid, would be thinking about all of the things that could go wrong. Let me explain.
I don't think my voice has changed that much.
It's almost the same,
almost
right?
Almost the same, yeah.
Giancarlo is 22 now, a college grad. He got in touch with me recently, told me he and his dad had a second book out. It's called The Waters of Our Time. Just like last time, Thomas took the pictures, Giancarlo did the writing. It's a beautiful little book with 142 photos that Thomas culled from 38,000 images, his life's work. They seem just to be snapshots, a kid getting something from the fridge, sulking on a bench, up at bat with his shirt off. They're all Giancarlo at different times in his life. But there are also lots of photos of a woman, brunette, slender. That's Thomas's wife, Anna. But Giancarlo's captions weave the pictures into a fictional story from the perspective of an elderly woman. It starts smack on the cover, like this.
I'm told I met my father, but if I did, I wasn't old enough to remember him. It seems silly at this age to be thinking of myself as someone's daughter, but I guess I still do.
And then there are other lines alternating with Giancarlo's in a gray italicized font. Those are song lyrics.
Well, the song is Follow. It was written by a man named Jerry Merrick. It's famously sung by Richie Havens, who's a big hero of mine, also a Brooklyn boy.
Can you read the first verse of the song?
Okay. Well, it begins, let the river rock you like a cradle.
Let the river rock you like a cradle.
Climb to the treetops, child, if you're able.
Climb to the treetops, child, if you're able.
Let your hands tie a knot across the table.
Let your hands tie a knot across the table.
Come and touch the things you cannot feel.
Come and touch the things you cannot feel.
Reading this book, I was trying to figure out why a 22-year-old guy would write a story from the point of view of an old woman. I asked Giancarlo about the book's dedication, and then I started to get it.
So the dedication of the book says, for Mary.
Yes. I have a sister who died the same day she was born when I was 4 years old. And that's who Mary is, and that's who the book is dedicated to.
Toward the end of the book, there's a picture of Anna sitting in a chair, hugging herself, looking distraught. Finally, on the last page, there's a baby dress, white and lacy, and laid out on an oriental rug, empty. It was Mary's. When Giancarlo was about 4, his mom was pregnant. More than halfway through her pregnancy, she went to the hospital with a high fever.
And I kept reassuring him that everything was going to be all right. But the last moment, a doctor came in, and she said, this is all wrong. We're going to lose her, meaning Anna. And get her into surgery immediately. I knew I had to get Giancarlo out of there. So I asked my friend to take him home.
And he put me on his shoulders and he brought me to the elevator. So my babysitter and I went to the elevator and I waved goodbye to him, to my dad who's standing outside. And the elevator, and this is what I remember most vividly, the elevator doors just did not close for whatever reason. And I kept waving, saying, bye, Daddy, he kept waving back. And I just remember the feeling of, it was almost like an out-of-body experience, like time had stopped for that moment, literally.
Mary lived just a few hours. When a baby dies, we mostly think of the grief of the parents. But there's Giancarlo with a sister he never met, wondering, imagining.
You know, would I have to live in the basement and she would have had my room? I mean, you know, what would it mean if I had to, you know, menace a prom date or something?
Giancarlo, of course, will never stop looping the what-ifs of Mary in his mind. But the book became his ultimate what-if. What if Mary had lived a full life and was looking back on all of it? What would she be thinking?
Just like playing out this, that narrative in my head so many times, it almost feels to me like it happened.
For Studio 360, I'm Hillary Frank.
Thomas and Giancarlo Roma's most recent book is called The Waters of Our Time. There's more from that story, which aired first on Hillary Frank's podcast at studio360.org. We hear all the time from listeners about some cultural work that changed their lives. And over the years, a lot of you have written to us about punk music, how the rawness and the DIY spirit affected you somehow. But Eve Orenstein was already a punk rocker when her life was changed by opera.
I'm an opera singer and director of Opera on Tap, Colorado. I was sort of fascinated with punk and hardcore from when I was like 9. I just thought it was really intriguing. I loved Gorilla Biscuits. All my friends from Jersey were already going to see the hardcore matinees at CBGB in New York. So I started taking the train in, and we were supposed to be 16 years old at the time to go to the hardcore matinees. And we faked some IDs and saw lots of amazing shows and lots of violence and lots of crazy. You know, I was teased a lot at school for the way I looked, and that didn't happen in the scene. People really thought I was cool and popular, and you know, you kind of had to prove that you were tough, but you didn't have to, you know, look a certain way. You know, there's definitely aspects of costuming in the underground scene, maybe not as much in the like hardcore scene, but certainly in like the goth scene. And but I was super fascinated with 18th century costume, certainly when I was 9, when we visited France, and I just saw these costumes and we thought it was just, you know, incredible what you could do with all that fabric. And so my mom brought me to see Figaro at Rutgers, at Opera Rutgers, and I don't remember a whole lot about the whole production. I know it was very traditional with, you know, the full 18th century dress, and there was the one moment, it's about to, like, go into crazy, everyone swapping costumes and identities, and she's looking for the pin, which is a big deal plot-wise, and she's lost this pin that she's supposed to deliver to the Count, and she's just completely lost. And it was definitely like the same sort of visceral experience that you get when you have this, you know, angry punk rock wall of sound coming at you. And for me, this one was just, you know, I have to be closer to this art. I have to sing that way. I ended up, when I was 14, going to a summer program where I could really study voice seriously for 5 weeks. And I knew at the end that I really wanted to be on stage singing opera. When I was undergrad, my teacher was very clear, you know, you need to grow your hair longer. You cannot have those facial piercings. I got a septum ring that I could flip up into my nose so I didn't have to have it out all the time. My septum ring did not affect my singing. I was definitely not allowed to get my tongue pierced. Because that definitely would have affected my diction. My husband, he makes analog synthesizers and somebody suggested that we work together, and my response was, how are we going to be in a studio together? He's completely self-taught, does not read music, and I'm so classically trained. How is this going to work? But he has complete mastery of these instruments that I know nothing about, and he respects my, you know, operatic training and voice. And so we do pure, straight-up opera with electronic, like, soundscapes. And that's a way that we have started working together and putting those worlds together.
Eve Orenstein runs Opera on Tap in Boulder, Colorado, and she listens to Studio 360 on KUVO. Our story was produced by Eric Malinsky. If there's a work of opera or punk or poetry or whatever that changed your life, let us know about it at studio360.org. Still ahead this hour, a performer who reinterprets songs from every decade of American history, all the way back to Yankee Doodle Dandy.
America was founded on booze, man-boy love, and dandy revenge.
Taylor Mack is just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy, a Yankee Doodle do or die, a real-life nephew of my Uncle Sam.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Have you had a chance to check out our new podcast? It is called Sideshow, and it's all about culture and art online, such as the hugely popular musician Pogo, who makes mashup songs like nobody else. And
I don't want nobody. I lost. Want nobody.
What I always loved about The Fresh Prince is that it wasn't just a barrel of laughs. It really had a soul to it, and I remember spending a hell of a lot of time going through all the episodes, trying to find the best bits and the bits that worked most, you know, musically.
That's from Sideshow, our new podcast. You can subscribe for free through iTunes or any podcast app, and you can check out our daily blog at studio360.org/sideshow. When you think of drag, you probably think crazy big wigs, high heels, fake Lizas and Judys, a kind of one-note over-the-top campiness. But a whole bunch of performers are out there showing that drag can do lots more than the original narrow stereotype. And surely the greatest of those artists in America right now is Taylor Mack, who is one of today's great theatrical artists, period. I became a Taylor Mack evangelist last year after I saw him at the Public Theater in New York, starring in Bertolt Brecht's Good Person of Szechuan. His current project, A 24-Hour History of Popular Music, is crazily ambitious. Mack goes back to the 1770s and takes on America's pop music decade by decade, all 24 of them, right up to the present, each decade distilled into about an hour. And before too long, he will put all those decades together into one vast 24-hour musical extravaganza that I really hope I get to attend. Taylor Mack, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me. It's really nice to be here.
Before we talk about that project and everything else related to you, may we hear a song?
Sure.
What will it be?
If your kisses can't hold the man you love, then your tears won't bring him back. And we do this in the 1920s show. What we do, I tell the story of these two gay men, Larry and Barry. And Larry, they were both in the war. And Larry's, the way he deals with the trauma of having been through the war is to squash the feelings down and not deal with them. And the way Barry deals with them is just to feel depressed. And so they're kind of fighting throughout the concert, Larry and Barry. And at a certain point, they decide to break up, and Larry is very sad about it, and Larry's fairy godmother comes and sings a song to him, and this is it.
Mm-hmm. Every time that I hear a woman cry that a man has left her flat, I just feel like saying, don't be such a fool, you fool. Come and dry your eyes, can't you realize that you gain nothing by that? That's no way to keep his heart warm when his love grows cool. What's the use of crying? What's the use of sighing when he's wandered off the track? If your kisses can't hold the man you love, then your tears won't bring him back. No use being tearful, you might as well be cheerful when he's giving you the sack. 'Cause if your kisses can't hold the man you love, then your tears won't bring him back. If sweet sugar kissing will not bring him home, how do you plan to keep him to you with tears and moans? So go be a regular fella, just say what the hella, grab his clothes and you help him pack. 'Cause if your kisses can't hold the man you love, then your tears won't bring him back. Home cooking is good and wholesome, but everybody needs a little mutton on the side every now and then. If you find your man is cheating on you, you just go out and you do the same. He's only given you the chance you've been waiting for all these years. You don't have to live a heteronormative narrative any longer. It's called liberation. Men, get them by the score. Neglected women shouldn't worry. That's what God made sailors for. So don't cry for him or chase him. Just go out and replace him with some good-looking Tom, Dick, or Jack. Kisses can't hold the man you love, then your tears won't bring him back. If your kisses can't hold the man you love, then your tears won't bring him back.
That was Taylor Mack, accompanied on piano by Matt Ray, performing If Your Kisses Won't Hold the Man You Love from the 1920s. That was fantastic. There was clearly some modern adaptation there in the talked parts.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And how historically accurate are you endeavoring to be, or will you take lots of liberties?
Oh, there's liberties.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I say it's my subjective history. I'm not a historian, and I don't have an interest in being a historian. I have an interest in history. And so I do a lot of research, and I like to reframe everything. So, for example, music from the 1770s, the whole decade has its own individual theme. Each one has their own theme. And the 1770s decade is about how America was founded on booze, man-boy love, and dandy revenge. And we basically go through the songs and we appropriate them.
You recontextualize them.
I mean,
yes.
In some ways we don't. For example, Yankee Doodle Dandy was originally sung by the British to make fun of Americans, saying that they were dandies, and they were false dandies. They were tacky dandies, you know. The British lost a particular battle, and so the Americans forced them to dance to Yankee Doodle Dandy while they sang it over and over and over again, and that's how it became an American song that we sing. So that there's a little bit of truth to my appropriation,
right?
You know, which is that our country was founded on dandy revenge.
Yes. Now, will it get tricky a little later in the 1840s and 50s when minstrelsy becomes the big thing?
Well, we've been doing them out of order.
Uh-huh.
So I haven't quite done the
40s, but I found this family of abolitionists. I think they're called the Hutchinson family.
Yes, they were huge stars
in
America.
Huge stars.
Yeah.
And my idea is that we do the 1840s will be just their music.
Uh-huh.
But then that always comes up is there's so many minstrel songs, and it's always a balance of, you know, not ignoring it,
yes.
But also not allowing that particular story to become the story of
right.
of what I'm doing.
But it seems like you can't ignore it. I mean,
no,
Stephen
no, no,
Foster,
no.
after all.
Oh, well, and so the 1850s we did, and we did a Walt Whitman, Stephen Foster mashup. So everyone says that Stephen Foster is the father of American song. So, but I think Walt Whitman is. So what we did was we basically pitted them against each other. Walt Whitman is the self-declared no sentimentalist, and Stephen Foster is a sentimentalist. And so we kind of use that as a way to kind of attack this minstreling of...
That sounds great.
Yeah, it's fun.
Gender identity and sexual identity obviously runs through most, if not all, of your work. Does that figure in every decade of this project or not?
Well, it's a queering of history. I really do think that that's... A lot of what I'm doing is
uh-huh.
finding where are my people in history,
yeah.
you know, even if I have to make them my people.
Yes.
I don't always focus on it for every decade.
You dial it back sometimes?
Yeah, but sometimes, but it's always present,
yeah.
you know, because it's just who I am and
right.
what I do.
Of course.
So I don't have to hammer people over the head with it because, yeah. I mean, they're looking at it. So,
as I've read things you've said and written, it strikes me that surprisingly, given... who you are otherwise and the characters you play, that you're kind of a theatrical conservative. You believe in story and craft and giving the audience what they want, right?
Oh, I wouldn't say giving them what they want.
Or at least satisfying them.
I try to give the audience what they need. And what I mean by that is I'm trying to be a student of humanity. And so I try to figure out what do people need at this time in their lives, kind of collectively. Oftentimes, it's just about figuring out what you need because you're a person and people will relate to you. You know, so,
yeah.
so that doesn't necessarily mean that the shows are always entertaining or fun or satisfying.
Right.
Sometimes they're really disturbing.
Right. But you are a show person, clearly. You like entertaining.
Yeah, I do. I do like to entertain people. That's true.
You were trained classically as an actor.
Yeah.
How and why and when did drag become the core of your performance?
The whole reason I do it is because I'm interested in homogeneity and heterogeneity. I grew up in a suburban town where everyone was supposed to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I've become very fascinated with that as a result. So my drag was about trying to take a topic and tear that topic apart and say what in a kind of postmodern way, you
mm-hmm.
know, and then look at all the pieces and then put them all back together again somehow and say what's the full range of what the topic looks like and feels like. And it's also about exposing what I look like on the inside. So people will often say, do you feel like you're hiding when you put on those costumes? And I say, no, what I'm doing is I'm exposing what I look like on the inside. So when I'm wearing my jeans and a t-shirt, that's when I'm hiding because I'm trying to blend in with everybody else.
And you don't, as far as I know, have never had a drag name.
No, I really did not want to have a drag name.
Because?
Because then you become, you know, Miss Alliance for the rest of your life
yeah.
or whatever, you know. And I think that's fun.
But it sort of trivializes it?
For me, it was about not hiding. So I just
right.
kind of wanted to expose who I was.
You performed and wrote this great thing called a theatrical manifesto, I believe,
mm-hmm.
in which much of it struck me. One of the tenets that really struck me was, quote, if we stop telling a majority of the people they won't like what we do, they would actually like what we do.
Yeah. But I'm really interested in recognizing that people actually – that avant-garde is commercial.
Especially if you don't call it avant-garde.
Right. And I see people enjoy avant-garde fashion all the time. Maybe they make fun of it a little bit or, you know, but they line up to see it. You know, it's the biggest selling show at the Met. You know,
Alexander McQueen, Met,
you know,
yeah.
is at the Met. And that's the biggest selling show in the history of the Met. And it's avant-garde fashion.
Yeah.
So what did the fashion industry do to encourage their audience to want to see avant-garde fashion and accept that performing artists and
they just called it fashion.
Right.
Will you do another song?
Sure.
And this one is?
Oh, we're going to do a Ted Nugent song.
What?
It's called Snakeskin Cowboy.
And this is from the 240-year thing?
Yeah, it's from the 1980s, or it might be 70s. I can't remember. Yeah. But
the Ted Nugent heyday, in any case.
Yeah, exactly. And what we did with it is we didn't want to actually have to listen to the song, because we just read the lyrics. I felt like we needed to do something by somebody who was a conservative, but I didn't want to listen to the song, so we just made up our own melody for it, and we're just singing his lyrics. And so we'll do that for you now.
Excellent.
To assume that this song, you can interpret it this way, that Ted Nugent was writing it to mean that he wanted to bash anyone who was dressed in fancy clothes and performing on a stage. So when I read the lyric, I thought, ooh, that song needs to be appropriated. So we've turned it into a junior high prom dance. And what we'd like the listening audience to do is to find someone next to you, and please just hold them and sway and just dance like you're at the junior prom. It doesn't matter what gender they are. If you're alone in your car or just listening to this by yourself, just hold yourself, because that's subversive. Because if you hold yourself, it means you're a little gay. And our point here is that we want to turn Ted Nugent into a gay. So that's what we're doing. We're gayifying his song. We're emasculating Ted Nugent. So just find your partner, hold them. If you don't do this, we really have to really do it. You have to do it. Because if you don't do it, Ted Nugent will win, and it'll be your fault. Here we go. Who the hell do you think you are?
dancing around with your high-heel boots. Don't think that should get you far.
That was Taylor Mack, accompanied again, this time on vocal as well as piano by Matt Ray, performing Snakeskin Cowboy.
Wonderful Matt Ray.
That was brilliant. And before I let you go, I'm going to give you a prediction about yourself.
Yeah.
You are, in a very few years, five max, going to be a MacArthur genius.
Oh.
Now, when it happens, you got it.
You're telling people that.
You have to thank me.
I'd like the money.
You heard it here first.
Sure. Absolutely.
I have never had this thought spontaneously about one of my guests before, but I did now.
Oh, you're very sweet.
I hope it comes true. Taylor Mack, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we are now at the end of this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening, all of you. You can hear a bonus track by Taylor Mack at our website, studio360.org. And you can keep up with us every day until the next show on our Facebook page. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Tal Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisvaram,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Pinnamaneni,
Ariel Roland Waring,
Marshall Bright,
Hannah Alonji.
And thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
For more than four decades, Linda Ronstadt has had one of the most iconic, beloved voices in popular music. Next time in Studio 360, she'll talk with me about her ups, her downs, and her inspiration.
A lot of the songs that I'd heard when I was a child, I thought were better songs than some of the mainstream pop things that I was getting.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.